My name's Michael Yusley. I'm a comic book geek. I'm a fanboy. I grew up loving comic books and reading comic books and collecting comic books. I was lucky enough, and I am also so old, that I was living within an hour of New York City when I was growing up, which is where all the comic book companies were based back then. And as a kid starting at age 13, comic book fandom was just starting. I was at the first Comic-Con ever held on the planet Earth. 200 of us showed up at a flea bag hotel in New York City. But that was my life, and I had a chance to go and hang out at the different comic book companies back in the 1960s and meet the editors and do tours and meet the artists. And I found out most of the artists and the writers and the creators from the 1930s to the 60s all lived in either New Jersey, New York, or Long Island. So I would beg my parents, and they would take me around, and I would have an opportunity to spend time with these people, these incredible people, and interview them and get the history firsthand. Well, along the years, one of the guys that I came to deal with is a man named Walter Gibson. Walter Gibson, as some of you who are here today probably know, was, if not the actual creator of The Shadow, was certainly the driving creative force of The Shadow. I annoyed and pestered this man to death, practically, because I wanted to know everything about The Shadow, everything about the history of pulps, everything about Street and Smith. I'm a history major, and I'm a history buff. So for me, the point of view was combining my love for comics with my love for history. It brought me to the pulps.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Mark Wade told me to let you know he's running about 10 minutes late. He apologizes.
No problem.
I'll be right here.
Great, thank you.
Typical.
Yeah, told you. So this is where my love for this stuff comes from. And I want to allow my compadres here to, and we're going to do this a little bit differently than most panels. I'm going to ask them now to introduce themselves and introduce to you how they were introduced to pulps and comics and why they have the same love affair that we all are attempting to bring to our work. We are so lucky. I had an opportunity to speak last night at the Harvey Awards, and my conclusion was, what do we do for a living? We report to a sandbox and play with our favorite toys. That's what we do every day. And now I'd like the fellas to introduce themselves and tell you about their love and passion for this.
Thanks, man. Good idea.
I'm Matt Wagner. Much like Michael, I was a bit of a few years behind Michael time-wise, but I grew up loving comics. My mom was an English teacher and always encouraged me to read. And that lesson sunk in. I'm a voracious reader to this day. I was an only child, and I grew up kind of out in the country, in Amish country in Pennsylvania, and not a lot of video entertainment back in those days. We got four stations in black and white, and so I drew to entertain myself. And comics were both drawing and reading all in one gorgeous little package. And unlike a lot of English teachers of her day, my mom didn't mind that I was reading comic books. She thought I'd grow out of them. Instead, I grew into them. So I was a voracious comic book reader, but my parents were World War II era. My dad was in World War II. So, you know, they always reported to me. They grew up listening to The Shadow on the radio. They remember it very distinctly, you know. So I had a genuine inherited nostalgia for this stuff from them. And my first exposure to The Shadow, therefore pulp literature from that springboard, was in the mid-70s when DC first announced they were going to do The Shadow run that was written by Denny O'Neill, illustrated by Michael Kaluta. Beautiful, beautiful series. And this ad showed up in the back of the DC books that was The Shadow. And he's aiming his guns at you. And comic book characters did not carry guns in those days, hardly at all. And so this was very intriguing to me. This guy looked dangerous, so therefore he was cool. And then shortly around the same time, you could all of a sudden get the original radio shows on the LP vinyl. Kids, LP vinyl were these round and then almost a year after that, Pyramid Books started republishing the actual pulp novels with these beautiful covers by Jim Steranko. So I had like a boom, 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 triple, fourple punch of The Shadow all within the space of a couple of years, and I I quickly grew to be as big a Shadow fan as you are. Everybody, check out my
Shadow team.
Custom made for me by Mr. Tim Sale.
That's Ed Cartier, one of the Shadow's greatest illustrators. So that's been just an obsession of mine for many years. Over the years, I kind of broke into the industry with my own creator-owned characters, and I've been lucky enough to go play with the, as he said, in the sandbox with the big boys' toys at various times. And you know, I've basically had my hands on all my favorites over the years. I've done Superman, I've done Batman, I've done Tarzan, I've done Zorro, I've done the Green Hornet, and just recently I finally got my hands on the Shadow, and it felt like a culmination of a great dream. And just this week, the first issue of my character crossing over with the Shadow came out. So if Michael's right that we're in a sandbox, I'm in a big giant sandbox. I'm just kicking sand everywhere. And I'll move it on to Francesca with that.
Francesco Francavilla. I was a little behind.
Yeah, right. So actually in the middle, we should be like a ratchet down here.
But of course, I mean, these big characters were popular all over the world. I mean, I grew up watching the Disney Zorro TV show, The Lone Ranger. I mean, the music, the Lone Ranger theme, and he going on the hill, and on the riding horse, and greeting at the end. I mean, it was one of the iconic image I was growing up with when I was this little kid. So, of course, I mean, I became a huge fan of the Shadow and all those pop characters. I mean, they were very, I guess, pop culture, popular culture. They were very famous all over the world, not just here in the States. Passion for all things pop eventually brought me to create my own pop character, which is the Black Beetle. And then, you know, I got like to draw the Shadow, the Green Hornet, to draw Zorro with this guy over here.
You're right.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed it. It was like, who doesn't know Zorro? It's like, it's everybody hero. It's one of the first heroes. Zorro was the inspiration for Batman, so, I mean, can get
Zorro and kind of the Shadow together.
So, I think everybody has a bit of, has to have a bit of love for pop, so, I mean, because they are part of, it's such a strong part of our culture that, you know, he has to be you.
Everybody here, obviously, if you're here for this panel, you like Pulp Fiction Publisher. If you have not checked out the Black Beetle, Francesco's book, it's awesome. He takes the aesthetics of the pulps, weaves it into his own character, and it's all that just good stuff we love. And
a little fresh.
Yeah, but with a fresh approach, and Francesco just draws so beautifully, it's a terrific book.
And he makes a great point here. When we were growing up, and again, I am by far the oldest of the group, we didn't have a lot of superheroes on TV and movies, but George Reeves' Superman show, that was pretty much the extent of it. So whenever anything appeared on TV that was something like a superhero, we went nuts.
Nuts.
Zorro and the Lone Ranger. They were good guys who wore masks. Oh my God, that's as close as we're getting. I was a humongous Zorro fan as a kid on the Disney Zorro and the Lone Ranger. And let me just prove to you, if I may, and this is maybe my only opportunity in life, just how geeky I am. With his faithful Indian companion, Tonto, the daring and resourceful masked rider of the plains led the fight for law and order in the early West. Nowhere in the pages of history can one find a greater champion of justice. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past come the thundering hoofbeats of the great horse Silver. The Lone Ranger rides again. That's how geeky I am. Later, we have a few beers. I will sing you the Zorro. But it really, really, really was true. And what are the pulps? How did the comics come about? What was the pulp influence? And when Mark Waid shows up, I'm going to have him as the historian tell you a little bit about it. But if you know anything about the history of rock and roll was this amazing combination of the coming together of rhythm and blues music with country western music. Comic books were the coming together of comic strips and the pulps. And that was kind of the background into it. I was lucky enough 39 years ago to become the writer of The Shadow at DC Comics following Denny O'Neill. And then Denny and I did every other issue for a short period of time. And I had never written a comic book before. I just want to tell this quick story. I was working summers as an intern that we were called Woodchucks at DC Comics in the 70s. And I was a junior in college, or a senior in college. I was a senior in college. And I'm getting ready to head back to New Jersey after a long, hard day working at DC Comics when I hear yelling and screaming coming from down the hall. Thought somebody was being killed. Ran down, it was Denny O'Neill's office. I go, Denny, are you okay? He goes, I'm not okay. He goes, I've got a crisis here. There is a script due tomorrow for the Shadow comic book. I don't have a script. I don't even have an idea for a story. I said, Denny, I have an idea for a Shadow story. He said, you do? I didn't. But I saw my first opportunity to get my foot in the door. So Denny said, all right, come in, sit down, Michael. He goes, what's your idea for a Shadow story?
No.
I said, oh, you're going to love this. It's really great. Now, my wife and I had just gotten back from a trip to Niagara Falls, where I learned that in the 1930s, which was where the Shadow comic was set, people were going over the falls in barrels. They were walking across the falls on a tightrope. I said, all right, picture this, Denny. Niagara Falls, a tightrope, the Shadow battling a bad guy on a tightrope over the falls, the searchlights going in the background. He goes, Michael, that's actually a really great cover idea, but what's the story about? I said, well, I'm glad you asked me that question. Because the story is about the smuggling. And he goes, well, what are they smuggling? I go, well, they are smuggling drugs. And he goes, but Michael, what's unique about it? What's the catch? I said, well, I've been saving this for the last part because this is really, really great. They were going over the falls in barrels back then. The drugs were hidden in the false bottoms of the barrels. They would go over the Canadian side, wash up onto the American side. That's how they're getting it through. He goes, well, that's a unique idea. He goes, could you have a full script on my desk at 6 o'clock tomorrow? I said, not a problem. He said, go do it. I'm now a writer for DC Comics. The next day, and this was before computers, folks, I come in with my handwritten script, and I'm still writing it, and I made a deal with one of the DC secretaries to start typing it up as I was feeding her pages. The deal I made with her to this day, I still can't reveal what the terms were. At the end of the day, I turned in the script. 2 weeks later, I'm walking down the halls of DC Comics, and who's coming toward me? Well, arguably, the most important editor in the history of comics, Julie Schwartz. Julie was the editor of Batman and responsible for Flash, Green Lantern, Justice League, Hawkman, the list goes on. And Julie was really gruff until you got to know him, and he was a real marshmallow. He sees me coming, my hair's down to my shoulders. He goes, hey, kid. I go, yes, Julie. He goes, I read your Shadow script. I said, you did? He goes, yeah. It didn't stink. I go, oh, Julie, thank you so much. Wow, thank you. He goes, how'd you like to take a crack at writing Batman? And that was how I got to start writing Batman when I was in college, which was a dream come true for me since I was 8 years old.
Right place at the right time.
Right place at the right time. And then, by a twisting and turning of events, I got to meet Walter Gibson. And ultimately, I got to work with Walter on a movie project we were developing, and he was our consultant. And that's where everything about The Shadow came together for me. Just like these guys mentioned, I first heard him on the radio in reruns on WJRZ in Newark, New Jersey on Sunday afternoons when I was growing up. And that completely entranced me. I then had the unfortunate experience of seeing a couple of Shadow movie serials, which were almost as bad as the Green Hornet movie serials. Very cheap and very bland. But I had
Victor Jory looked the part, though.
Victor Jory was the best looking one of the whole group. To this, you know, for a while I was working on a Shadow movie project with Sam Raimi, and they said to me, "If you could pick any star today, who would be your vision of the Shadow?" And that was pretty interesting to me. And I would love to hear your versions of that before I tell you who mine would be. So I have had this association. 39 years after I wrote The Shadow originally, I get the call from Nick Barucci. Would you come out of Shadow retirement to write the first meeting of The Shadow and the Green Hornet? And man, you know, there was no way I could say no to that. I was so utterly, utterly thrilled to do it. And it was a great, great experience. And now I'd like to ask these guys about their experience working for Dynamite on the pulps today in the 2000s and what it's like trying to take characters, both in terms of story and characterization and in art and perspective. How do you marry the past and the purple prose of the pulp era with the sensibilities of contemporary graphic storytelling? And I'd like you guys to address that.
Well, I'm kind of a firm one for keeping The Shadow back in those time periods. You know, I really like, he's a product of that time. So I was, when I got the chance to do The Shadow, I was determined it was going to be then. And in fact, you know, I asked Nick if I could do The Shadow Gear 1, the story of
Mark Waid is alive.
I had done several year ones already for Dynamite. Zorro year one and the Green Hornet year one.
Yeah, I have a pick. I have a moment pick with you by Green Hornet year one, but keep going.
Yeah, because I killed his dad.
Yeah.
Anyway. So it was distinctly going to be, you know, just after the Depression had started, very much in that time period. But again, you take a different approach in regards to how much space is given to each moment in the story. You know, a different, much different approach. You know, when you look at the Denny O'Neill run, just preceding Michael's efforts there, you know, you look at that, and there's, what, 7, 8, 9, 10 panels a page sometimes. Yeah. And, you know, nowadays, I just don't find that suits a modern aesthetic, you know. Unless you are distinctly using it in a design sense and really trying to crowd up a page. But I tend to open up the pages a little bit more and have a little more space for action and grandiosity. And, of course, those are just absolutely endemic to any pulp narrative. And you can get a little rougher with the subject matter, even though the pulps were fairly rough. But, you know, you can deal with prostitution, you can deal more with drugs, you can deal with a more distinct level of violence, you know, as opposed to just blazing guns. You see the effect of those blazing guns.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing I love about that early pulp stuff, and in fact the very earliest incarnation of superheroes and comics, which were so influenced by the pulps, is that they're so raw and unfettered, you know. Those guys are making that stuff up as they go along. They did not have a template to follow. They are not following tropes that have come over the last 50 years, you know. And so, you know, the pulp novels, per se, you know, those authors, not the best wordsmiths, but certainly the best idea smiths, you know. Stuff just, their imaginations were so unbounded and just flew free as could be. You know, when you read Edgar Rice Burroughs' work these days, you know, again, language a little creaky and a little flowery, purpley, as Michael said, but oh my God, the worlds he imagined and the level of swashbuckling daring do is just not to be found in modern literature.
That was one of the things that was heartbreaking to me about the John Carter movie, is that so many people who, you know, were younger were looking at this going, oh, I've seen all this stuff before.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It felt repetitive to them when, in fact, you know, I wanted to stand up in the theater and go, no, this, they invented this stuff here.
Yeah, the sad part about the John Carter movie was the best part was this part on Earth.
Yeah.
It's like that scene where he carves through the ape. That should have been like the second scene, you know? I mean, it should have been savage, and it wasn't at all.
Yeah, I mean, there is, I think, an evolution in the graphics from the period to nowadays. In the way of layouts, in the way of colors, compositions, and so I mean, I think I have a bit of a classic style, you know, which is the reason why probably I got asked to do the pops in the first place, because my style reminds me a bit, you know, those old school illustrators. But I try to think mostly in the colors and the composition to give a fresh new look to these subjects, so, and it seems to be clicking with people, so I think I'm on the right path.
Yeah, I think you're doing okay there.
Yeah. Mark, two things. We're talking about the challenges in terms of taking something that's rooted in the pulps and in the 30s and making it contemporary and relevant in terms of the writing, the dialogue, the characterization. And then I'd love for you to address the history of it and how the characters of the pulps have inspired and in some places directly influenced the creation.
And by the way, my apologies for being late. Couldn't be helped, but here I am. Thank you for being patient. To the first question about how to make the stuff that is set in that period still feel relevant and contemporary, for me, it was coming down specifically with Green Hornet. It was realizing that I wasn't telling a superhero story, that I didn't approach it that way. I knew I was telling a crime story. That this is not, forget capes and masks and cloaks and stuff. This is about a guy who is basically trying to infiltrate the mob and to be a badass. And then what that leads you to are some really interesting and very dark decisions that you have to make if you go down that road. That the contemporary angle on it was less about the trappings and less about the setting and the year and the set dressings. It was about, well, in the 30s and 40s, you could get away with the idea that the Green Hornet was not, you know, he was pretending to be a bad guy, but he really wasn't doing anything that bad. We live in a post Breaking Bad, you know, in a world in which we moral ambivalence is a lot more of an interesting driving force of drama. And so being able to write, read, really having to make some, and sometimes failing, sometimes making the wrong choice, but having to make some very hard decisions about, how far do I take this role and what lines am I willing to cross in service of a greater good. The good news about that is a timeless tale. That is a character dynamic that it doesn't matter where in history you set that, it will feel contemporary, because those are questions that we wrestle with on a personal level every day. What are the good parts of us? What are the bad parts of us? But I mean, that said, as you said, all of these characters are so insanely influential to we. We talk about mashup culture now and remix culture like we invented it in the last 10 years. And in fact, so much of those early Superman stories, so much of that early Batman material, so much of the early, the early urban adventure stuff was written and drawn by guys who were living and breathing and absorbing and eating, shadow pulps and Doc Savage pulps and spider pulps the same way that we do with comics today. So it was just being funneled in, and because there was that, everything was a periodical nature back then. There was no sense, if you bought a shadow story, if you bought one of the shadow stories, in 1929 out of the pulp or whatever, and 1931, next month there's another one on the stands, there's no access to the last one. It's all, it's all very transitory. So I'm not saying that people deliberately stole plot ideas or character ideas or elements deliberately and said, I get to reuse this in a few months because nobody will notice. It's just that was the cycle of it, right? That was just the way that was part of the job. You would think this is something that you read 10 years ago in a pulp magazine if you were Bill Finger. And it would never occur to you that you were stealing or even swiping. You were just influenced, and then that's the way it worked.
Yeah, in fact, the first Batman story is a direct lift of a Shadow novel.
Yeah,
and I you get the feeling that they didn't even quite realize they were doing it. It wasn't deliberate.
Tony Collin, Tony Collin found it. It was the November 1936 Shadow Stories, Partners of Peril, which has been reproduced. Now what you have to understand is Bill Finger, whom I met twice when I was a kid, and you might seriously consider him to be a co-creator of Batman for his contributions. Bill Finger always said that his part in the creation of Batman came from the Shadow, or was inspired by or influenced by the Shadow. And nobody ever questioned what he meant by came from, influenced by, inspired by, until Tony found this story. This story is basically the case of the Chemical Syndicate from Detective Comics number 27. I mean, down to certain dialogue. It is right smack that.
The death trap.
The death trap.
Yeah.
And here's what why I say it was more than, gee, maybe it was in the back of their minds. Bob Kane took Cartier's artwork and duplicated it in Detective Number 27. You could see the actual drawings of the glass trap coming down, the little devices in the background, the mechanical devices. They were all come right out of the spot illustrations from that November 1936 Shadow Story.
All right, so there's a fucking thief.
there was thievery afoot, but nobody cared.
No.
A lot of these stories, and I know there will be some lawyers who will really go crazy when I say this, were never properly copyrighted and trademarked. Copyrights were not renewed. A lot of it went into the public domain.
Well, they were meant to be trans story, like Mike.
Exactly.
Like they were disposable entertainment.
I've always used the analogy always. Imagine your job today is writing descriptions for TV Guide. And that's your job. You're not going to get upset if 6 months from now someone is actually using your same descriptions for what you wrote for an episode of Gilligan's Island. That's your job. You don't expect it to have any lasting value or whatever. And I think that's a pretty fair assessment of how a lot of these creators saw their work back then. It was just, I'm banging it out, I'm getting a check, I'm telling a good story, but next month is a whole other round of stuff. And there's no archives, there's no preservation.
9 to 5, yep. Workmanlike.
It's true. Bill Finger never sat down and said, I'm going to write this character that's going to live forever in modern day mythology. He said, all right, one more character to do. So it didn't matter to him that he quickly met his deadline by borrowing all of these elements to get this story out, because he figured 2 months from now, who the hell's going to care? Right. Who's going to remember it? Get it out.
And I will point out, sometimes these guys rip themselves off.
Yeah.
Because the guys that created the Lone Ranger also created the Green Hornet.
Yeah.
And the Green Hornet is supposed to, in fact, be the Ranger's nephew. But if you look at it, they both wear a mask and operate outside the law. They both have a special weapon. They both have an ethnic sidekick. They both have a special means of transportation that's named after a color. And they both have a wacky piece of classical music as their theme song.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same character.
But did they have to name his faithful Indian companion Tonto, which I later in high school found out meant stupid in Spanish?
There again, I bet they didn't know that one. You know what I mean? Sounds good.
In Italian, too.
So what I'd like to do at this point, before we continue our discussion, is see if any of you have questions, comments, and
For like a young creator like me, what would you give as a tip for making comics?
Are you an artist or a writer or both?
I'm both.
Why don't we start with Matt?
Draw every single day. It's the same as if you were a musician or an athlete. You would train every day. You would practice every day. You must draw every day. And you need to draw not superheroes. You need to draw cars and telephones and, cell phones. Pigeons and grass and houses and everything. You need to be able to draw everything. So, draw the fun stuff too, but draw, in the background, make sure you draw the other stuff which you're going to need to draw. As far as writing, you need to read a lot. You cannot write if you don't read a lot. That's just the absolute truth.
Princess, so how did you start? How did you become the artist? What drove you?
I don't know, because far as I remember, I was always drawing, and my stuff was on the wall of the elementary school and middle school, because it was always the best stuff. So I thought that it was a more common thing, but eventually I found out people go to school to learn to draw, and I just had it, so I never done any school. But I did draw a lot, he's giving really good advice. All I can add is put stuff by the window, see how the light hit an object. Get the volume of all things, like the shadows. Especially, today there's so much line on colors, so do just the lines, but if you know the volume of things, how they cast the shadows, you can use that to great advantage in telling a story.
It'll give your art solidity that is often lacking in a lot of stuff.
Mark, what's your evolution as a writer?
If it makes you feel any better at all, I never grew up wanting to be a writer. I never thought I would be a writer. And really, until that age 23 or 24, I wasn't even further along than you are right this second. So you've got at least 12 years on.
But you were a reader, right?
I was a reader, but I just figured I'd be an editor. I just figured I would be, I knew the characters, I knew kind of how stories worked, and it really wasn't until I got in there and realized, well, I can tell my own stories. And really the biggest breakthrough and the thing you should always bear in mind when you're writing a story is know what a story is. A story is, when you tear everything else away from it, a story is somebody wants something and something's in his way. And we have to care about why he wants it, what it is he wants. We have to care about the guy who you're telling your story about. Whatever reason he wants to get this thing, whatever it is, you have to believe in it. You have to, you have to sympathize with it to some degree. And then whatever obstacles you put in his way, they have to be pretty amazing and pretty hard to overcome. And that's, you'd be stunned at the number of experienced writers who I hear from who don't understand that that's basically what a story is. Somebody wants something, something's in his way. Is that a fair assessment?
It sure is. Mm-hmm. You know, when I started working at DC Comics, they had started a portfolio review looking for new young artists to come into the fold. And in preparing your portfolio, which would be absolutely essential, DC was always looking for three things. Number one, can you draw anatomy appropriately? Have you had training? Do you understand anatomy? Number two was they want to see sketches of not superheroes, as Matt said. They want to see how you draw a car or a chair or the folds of a sleeve of a shirt. Number three, they told all of the candidates, take 2 to 4 pages of any comic book you choose, read those 2 to 4 pages, ignore the art, and then show us how you would tell the story over those 2 to 4 pages. They want to see your graphic storytelling ability. In terms of writing, you got to remember this. People aren't simply creative writers. There's more to it than that. Everybody in Hollywood has their own screenplay that they're trying to sell or peddle. Very, very few understand it's a craft that you have to learn and master. And there are some great books on it for like screenwriting that also apply to comic book writing as well. Sid Field's book is one of the classic books about it. But understand it's a craft, and you need to hone your skill as a craftsman if you're going to be a good writer.
Yeah, like I said, like an athlete or a musician.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, to spring off something Michael said, if you want, my suggestion would be, don't just look at 4 or 5 pages of a comic and then go do it your own way. I would encourage, like your dad, to look at the 4 or 5 pages and just write down on, like, here's what happens in this panel. Here's what happens in this panel. Don't even look at it. Just then go draw it, and then when you're done, go look at it and compare with what was printed and see what works and see if
they. Yeah, that's a good
idea. Thank you.
And also, I would like to add on something that Michael said. The importance to know how to draw a table, a chair, a car, is because even in superhero comics, I mean, it's not like you get to draw a superhero from page 1 to page 20. I mean, you got maybe five pages. Then the rest of the book is people talking, doing normal stuff. So you need to know how to draw normal stuff. Because that's what most of the books are about. I mean, yeah, people talking. I had to draw many pages with just talking heads, and you have to sell that. You need to be good.
You have to make that part. Yeah. The boring part's interesting.
Yeah,
yeah,
right.
Right.
So.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question. It's a great question, sir.
You mentioned earlier about writing for contemporary eyes as these characters from the Depression era. At what point does that writing cross over at getting too contemporary that it no longer becomes time-sensitive, that it no longer becomes the characters of the 30s anymore? That's always been a minor beef I've had. But
an easy thing I can point to in this is racial situations. Of course, you know, we as modern writers want to treat it with more sensitivity, and yet you can't hump these characters' opinions up of... You know, you still have to have some racial slurs in there. You have to make it contemporary to its time. Additionally, attitudes towards women, stuff like that. So, yeah, you're right. There's a fine line to balance there, but I think it's very doable.
In retrospect, all of us should have a lot more of the characters smoking cigarettes and all.
Yeah.
That.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I have lots of cigarette smoking in my older stuff.
My first gig at Marvel was the Black Panther, and the opening scene is that he breaks in this warehouse with, you know, the bad guys are playing cards, and So I draw and have everybody smoking. I am smoking because it's a noir city. Right. It's these bad guys. And then, you know, I turned that in and I said, oh, wait, nobody told you Marvel has a no smoking policy.
Really?
I said,
yeah. Bad guys can smoke.
What does no smoking So, yeah.
Okay,
I said, how are you making a bad guy without a cigarette?
I got a funny story on that. You were talking about the Disney Zorro stuff. My first experience with Zorro was the area I lived in had a UHF station that would play silent films on Sunday night. So my first Zorro experience was the original Douglas Fairbanks Sr., the Martin Zorro. Yeah. And it's fabulous. And there's a scene at the beginning where the soldiers are in this tavern, and Big Sergeant Gonzalez is thundering and blustering about how he's going to catch Zorro, and then this dark cloaked character kind of sneaks in from the back, and they're all like, who is this? Who is this person? And he comes up doing the Batman thing, pre-Batman, and it's Zorro. Zorro's not like this, and he's puffing on a cigarette. Just like, ha!
All right, now that's
so there's a completely different view of
that sets off a story for me. When I originally bought the rights to Batman, the movie rights to Batman from DC Comics, and we went out to try to set up Batman as a dark and serious film, our first screenwriter who was brought on board was a wonderful creative man named Tom Mankiewicz. Tom was the script doctor on the first two Superman movies. He wrote a couple of great James Bond films. He went on to do Heart to Heart on TV, if you remember that. And I sat Tom down and everybody else who was going to be associated with the project, and I had the Betamax tape, show you how old I am, of The Mark of Zorro. And I made everybody watch this one sequence to understand Batman that felt they needed to understand Zorro in this way. And if I remember correctly, Zorro tells the Comandante he's going to have breakfast.
This is the chase scene in the middle.
The chase scene in the middle. He's going to have breakfast in the middle of the garrison at this place, and he dares them to try to stop him. So they set this table with breakfast on it, a napkin, silverware, whatever, with a bench there, and it's surrounded by every single soldier you could imagine. And Zorro comes riding in, Douglas Fairbanks, the singer. And there are scenes like him coming in feet first through a window, landing on the chair, taking a bite of food, and launching himself out the window over on the other side. And it is the most... If you have a chance to see this sequence...
If you look it up on YouTube, that you can watch just that sequence.
It's absolutely...
Dude, he's doing all his own stunts, too, by the way.
And I had an opportunity in life to be friendly with Doug Fairbanks Jr. and talk to him about the whole thing and what his father did. But it was so influential that even when we were putting together the first Batman movie, I felt everybody really needed to be cognizant of this.
No, that's good source. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
So I know within Dynamite there are rights holders to these characters that you have to run stories by. But outside of that, when these pulps were being published in the 30s, this stuff was very... it was scary, right? It was scary. It was dirty. It was, the limits of what they could do at the time. How do you balance doing the same thing now without making this be like, rated X or rated R, and or not making it just be a complete tribute to the past and not evolving further?
I wish Howie Chaykin was here.
Yeah. Well, in my case, it was like I said earlier about knowing I was writing a crime book and taking it a little bit further along those lines, but. I understand your question. You guys, Michael, what means look?
Well, Howard always touches on this. He takes it a little farther than I do. But with the Shadow, you have to have the, you root for the Shadow, but he's pretty fascistic. He's like, I'm going to judge you. I know what's best, and if you don't meet my judgment, I'm going to kill you. And he has no qualms with that. So that's a neat, for instance, the Hornet doesn't really kill. Zorro tries not to. Occasionally, a sword goes through somebody. The Shadow has no trouble gunning people down.
No.
I'm dealing right now with a very interesting project, Justice Incorporated at Dynamite. And the first issue is on sale now. The second one comes out September 17th. Stan Lee taught me how to do the plug things. And my challenge was, this is the first time in 75 years that these Trinity heroes of Street and Smith, then Condé Nast, are brought together. I can't even fathom that this has not happened before. Closest we came, there was some great Doc Savage Shadow crossovers, And 39 years ago, I was privileged to write for DC the Shadow number 11, Night of the Avenger, in which the Shadow and the Avenger crossed over.
I had that one, buddy.
Yeah.
I had all those ones you mentioned. At that.
It was such a great
The Niagara one had a Joe Kubert cover, right?
But guys, you'll appreciate this. At that time, DC had just cut back its page count from 20 pages to 18 pages. And on the 18-page story, where I was told it would be one issue only, you had to wrap this up in one, the first page had to be a full-page splash that couldn't be part of the story continuity. So I had 17 pages to present the Shadow, all his agents, the Avenger, all his agents, the villain, and actually try to figure out if there could be a readable plot, and I had 17 pages to do it in. So that was
old
quite
school,
crazy.
Michael.
Very old school. But now, I've got these three characters, and you cannot find three characters with more diverse methodologies and ideologies in the history of the pulps or comics. So here you have the Shadow, who's judge, jury, and executioner. He is out to just do what's right as far as he understands what's right and wrong. Then you have the Avenger. He's interested in justice. And believe me, that immediately sets up a very, very shaky alliance with the Shadow. Because the Avenger does not want to kill. That's not part of justice. And the Shadow's going, well, what the hell is justice to you? What does that mean? Is justice the law? The law's worth nothing. It's frustrating. It's corrupted. It's red tape. It's bureaucracy. And then you've got Doc Savage, who just wants to do what's best for humanity. And the conflicts are so much fun to deal with. But it kind of represents the different ways that the pulps went. Yeah. Other questions?
I'm sure you've read the, what is the name of it? Any pulp fan should read the Chinatown Death Cloud Herald.
Oh, yeah. The pastiche that was done.
So this is a mystery novel where Lester Dent teams up with Walter Gibson to solve a mystery.
Yeah.
And so you have Doc Savage, his creator, teaming up with the Shadow's creator, and they, you know. And L. Ron Hubbard's in it, and Robert Heinlein, and H.P. Lovecraft makes a cameo. It's really fun.
Gibson told me stories about L. Ron Hubbard.
He's kind of like the little eager beaver tag along in the book, you know.
Yeah, I got a great story I can't tell publicly. Go ahead.
No, I think there's also, I hope I use the right word here, the inherent difference between. What was the Shadow many years ago, which was the novels. So you have written words, and then the radio show, which I'm a huge fan of. When you hear, oh, the Shadow is here, where are you? I'm right here behind you. But, you know, you don't see it. It's audio, so you're making stuff in your head. But now with the book, you have to show the Shadow. So you have to deal a bit with, okay, I'll show something that... the characters did not see, or you know, so it's a different dynamics from the original part.
Oh yeah, there's a hybrid with the radio show. There has to be. You know, every time I sit down to write, I keep hearing in my head that.
This show's brought
well, and
by
I find when, I find when I've approached the Shadow, I mean, I'm distilling all those different versions because again. We all consider the pulps kind of the definitive version, but to the public at large, the radio show was their one and only exposure to the character. And the radio shows, if you listen to them, they're exciting, but he really doesn't do anything. He's more like a spook. He just, you know, spooks people to confess or run off the cliff or whatever, you know. He doesn't have any guns. And in the pulps, he really didn't have much in the way of psychic abilities. In the radio show, that's all he has. And, you know, when I was talking to some other younger readers, I realized that the Alec Baldwin film was their one and only exposure to the Shadow. So I tried to distill part of that into my version as well. And that's, you know, when you have a character this long-lasting, you probably do the same with Batman, right? You pick and choose the little parts you like over 75 years, and you make them, you know, your particular brew.
Other questions?
Sir?
I wanted to ask what you thought of the original pulps. How they wrote them. That I see Street and Smith characters as almost like DC characters.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have an internal dialogue in their heads. You never know what the Shadow's thinking, Doc Savage is thinking, or the Avenger. The other assistants you may know, but the heroes you don't. And then with the Spider, he's a Marvel character because it's all internal dialogue of, oh my God, everything's falling apart all around me. Nita's going to die. Everybody's going to die. They're going to find out my identity. And it's almost Marvel-like.
That's a really good
observation. Yeah, that is an observation. Yeah, yeah.
Now I'm going to go back and reread.
It's all agony.
Oh, yeah. You know, to follow on that, whenever I write The Shadow, I never have internal narrative. I always have Margo narrating.
You never know what the hero thinks. They're almost DC characters.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good observation.
That's terrific. That's really good. By the way, if you've never read any of these old Spider novels, oh, my God.
They're just
insane. They start 50 pages into where every other pulp story would have started back in the time. You know, you'll open it up and suddenly Richard Remford is already on the run because he's being framed for murder, and there's giant robots coming in across his hand. Page one. And then he's just insane as a character.
Other questions?
He had one right here.
Sorry.
Before Mark came in, you talked about the scarcity when you were younger of genre stuff on TV. Like, if there was anything there, you grabbed it. Because if there's 112 TV shows, there may be one, like Star Trek. And I was just wondering if what I liked as a kid was the Filmation. I liked the Filmation Lone Ranger, Zorro, Tarzan cartoons. I just wonder if that brought anyone any pleasure.
Pleasures. There was such a dearth in those days. You just clung to any. I was excited when Spider-Man showed up in the Electric Company.
Yeah.
And I'm not kidding. I tuned in just to see that, you know.
Yeah, it's really true. The cartoons, by the time the cartoons came for me, I was already like in junior, senior high school, so it didn't have the impact if I was younger at that moment in time. Again, if you want to have a few beers later, I will sing you the theme song to both the Superman Aquaman Hour of Adventure and the Marvel Superhero Show.
Speaking of pops and cartoons, I grew up watching the old Popeye, which this year is going to be 85 years old. So it's kind of cool because we're celebrating Batman 75. But Popeye is 85, so it's been around a little longer.
Just a little bit. And yeah. Another influence.
2019 will be Zorro's 100th.
Incredible.
Yeah.
That is incredible.
Do you know why spinach is perceived as, why spinach is perceived as Popeye's strength-giving thing?
Was it cartoons?
Well, the thing is, back during that time, it really was presupposed that spinach really did have so much iron and so much potency in it that it really was a strength food for people. Mm. It was like a health food. Only in later years, much longer, long after it became a part of Popeye's shtick, the squeezing of the spinach can and the expanding muscles, did the FDA do research and look back at all the research that had gone into studying some of the foods like spinach and realized that decades ago, someone in some department had put a decimal place in the wrong point in terms of the actual amount of iron that's in spinach. And it's really nothing compared to anything else. Some guy in some clerical office in Washington, D.C. made a math mistake, and Popeye now gets a strength for spinach.
And, of course, that's endemic to the cartoons. The strip, the strip really didn't have the spinach stuff.
It's,
but the
it's better than, you know, a can of broccoli.
Yeah. This thing Stan could have had Tony Stark overeating spinach. That would be amazing. Another question. We got a few more minutes. Yes, sir.
Well, gets back to your one question about the no smoking thing, and I don't. But where does the kind of the common sense factor come in? And it'd be like, you know, who has the final say? The lawyers or the editor or the owner? Because it's like if you were to do a cartoon for World War II or Vietnam, you know, it's like you can't have this without having that.
Yeah.
The answer is very fluid. If you're doing something like The Spirit, for example, there are certain restrictions that Will Eisner family will put on you in terms of what you can do with The Spirit or what you can't do with The Spirit. If you're going to do something with Batman, there are restrictions from DC as to how he looks, how he operates, what he does and what he doesn't do. If you're doing a Marvel movie, Marvel's going to have tons of commands as to how these characters can behave and can't behave. If you're doing something that's lesser known or hasn't lasted all of these years continuously, and you have an opportunity to rebrand him and bring it back, then you typically have a lot more latitude in what you're able to do.
They're just happy you're using their property.
Yeah. But once you get past the owner level, then it becomes a thing between the publisher, the editor, and yourself as a creator. And depending on what group you're working with will determine how much control they cede to you as a writer and artist, or how much that they want to adhere to a policy that they may have for all of their comics.
And it can be very individual. When I was writing Zorro, there was a woman in charge. Zorro's owned by a group called Zorro Productions. It's their only property.
I remember that.
And there was a woman in charge, and she was so persnickety. And she would object to stuff that was just outlandish. Why are you objecting to this? And I had one scene where they're collecting taxes, the peons are complaining, and the big bad sergeant says, all right, you know, tonight we'll accept another payment. He cuts off one of the peasant's fingers. And he says, but every finger's worth only 10 pesos. And she wrote a note in my script, says, oh, do we have to have cutting off fingers? Yeah. I know in some Muslim countries this is a punishment, but we're talking about Catholic Spain.
Why?
I had to point out to her that the Inquisition was Spanish. And it was a really common thing to do in all areas of the world, all cultures.
Also, Zorro can have a gun.
He could pick up somebody else's gun, but he couldn't carry a gun. It had to be only the sword and the whip.
We have time for one more question and then the closing comment. Yeah.
First, I want to say thank you to all of you for writing and drawing some fantastic pulps and keeping my heroes alive. They're really some of the best characters out there. I'm trying to pay it forward with my boys, but I got to tell you, we're competing with movies and we're competing with video games. So since you're four of the brightest, strongest pulp minds, you've probably created the modern pulp genre with Thrill Bend and your weekly serial novels coming out.
In that direction.
I don't think anyone has the credentials you have, Mr. Ruslan, and writers and artists. It's phenomenal. What are we going to do to take pulp in the 21st century and beyond?
Keep an eye out. Stay tuned regarding Doc Savage and cinema. I hope there will be a major announcement coming up early next year.
How cryptic.
And I think just the fact what Dynamite is doing and allowing us to play in the sandbox with these characters and allow us to try to do something that helps pay it forward, I think is really important.
And I'm sure all of these guys will agree, Dynamite's really good with being hands-off.
Yeah.
They really support their creators, and they want you to play, and they want you to bring our strengths to these characters. You know,
I have the feeling that the pulp is coming back anyway. I mean, it's it wasn't like in the 90s and 2000, but I see more and more pulp popping up all over the place. So it's so like there's a new law for the genre.
Yeah.
So I think we are on the right.
Let me also say this, that I hope will give you some hope about the future, and something I've thought about a lot too, that yes, we have to compete with video games, we have to compete with cable television, we have to compete with the internet, we have to compete with all this stuff, but you know what we had to compete with when we were kids, and you and I were kids? Going outside, you know, and riding your bicycle everywhere, and playing sandlot baseball, so there's always been other things that kids can do besides read comics. We just have to keep telling stories that make sense to them, that engage them and engage their imagination, and that's all we can do and hope the rest of them. But I reject this notion that we are competing more for their attention than we ever when we were in 1945.
Because there were girls in 1945 too.
Yeah, exactly.
To wrap it up,
and they're a pretty big distraction, and they were for me.
To wrap it up, I just want to share with you quickly my favorite Walter Gibson story.
Please.
This is a story Walter told me. You probably know he was a master magician. He was the last living associate of Harry Houdini's. And he wrote a lot of books on magic and books on Houdini. And Walter told me about the one time he witnessed Houdini in a trap in which he was unable to escape from. And he said he had never really shared this before, but he wanted to tell me this story. Harry Houdini was going to the theater in New York one night with his wife and with Walter and his wife. They were in a touring car. Harry and the two ladies were in the back. Walter, who was a pretty big guy at that time, sat in the front next to the driver, and off they went. It was an evening of a torrential rainstorm in New York City. And as they pulled up to the Broadway Theater, they pulled right up. The marquee was right there that they could get under in this rain. Walter jumps out, puts the collar up on his tuxedo, jumps under the marquee, And then Harry goes to get out of the back of the car to open the door, and he's working the door and jiggling the handle, and he cannot get out of the back door. Walter then holds onto his lapel, goes over, and opens the car door from the outside. The two ladies come out, and as Harry comes out, he grabs Walter by his lapels and says, "If you ever tell a soul about this, I will kill you." Thank you very, very much.